Hello, everyone, and welcome into another episode of the Homeward Path Podcast. My name is Adam, and this is the show by MTG Dads for everyone at home who's listening. I'm not even going to try to be exclusive about it anymore. This week, we had the Magic World Championships won by Javier Dominguez, and we're going to celebrate that and cover kind of the other big story to come out of the World Championships that actually has very little to do with the World Championships, but we'll get there. And I'm going to talk about some of the deck building traps I'm trying to avoid for Guilds of Ravnica Standard. But first, we got to thank the people who make this show possible. It begins with the rest of the network over at constructivecriticism.com. There is so much content on this network now. We just added another show. Mason Clark and Trey McLaren are doing their own show for PPTQ, RPTQ grinders who are, you know, people who are aggressively trying to get to the Pro Tour right now. And that show is called Even Odds. Of course, we have the original flagship show for the network, Constructed Criticism, that is the professional perspective on constructed formats, you know, from the mouths of the people grinding it out right now. And we have the same type of approach to pauper play in Common Knowledge. So, I mean, just the actual podcasts on the network are fantastic. I am excluding myself from that still. That's just how I feel about it anyway. The other shows on this network are fantastic, people. And there's additional content with the streaming that they do for the Trophy Mages. They added a new Trophy Mage, so that's something exciting. And there's just a lot to look forward to on this network. And speaking of things you can look forward to, you can check out our sponsor at inkgaming.com and look forward to saving 10% off your order by using the promo code CCMTG10 at checkout. You can get all the playmats, you can get all the mouse pads, dice bags, backpacks, like all the things. All of the things. They have them. And that you can use the promo code and get 10% off of all the things. Why would you not? It's so nice. And then if you would like to donate to the show directly, you can do so at patreon.com/homewardpathmtg. We have no new patrons this week, so I have no one to shout out. If you feel like you are getting something back out of this show, enough that you want to donate, but when you look at the page, you don't like the patron rewards, please just let me know. I am very much open to change on those, so don't feel like those are something that's set in stone. So if patron rewards are the only things that are holding you back, please just give me a heads up. I will be happy to change them within reason. So this week we had the Magic World Championships, and you would not be alone if you are just now finding that out. Apparently, it was one of the worst promoted events I've ever seen. I found out by reading Magic Twitter on Friday. That's how I found out Worlds was last weekend. It was right in the middle of it. So, Javier Dominguez took the tournament down, and that was exciting to see because Javier Dominguez has been one of the most consistent performers on the Pro Tour over the last year. I mean, he was second at last year's World Championship and then proceeded to cash or top eight numerous Pro Tours over the course of the year, was, you know, a fixture on the Grand Prix scene. He was just everywhere. And was competitive at all of the events that he was playing in. So it was great to see somebody who really put in the work this year win the championship this year. As well as Ultimate Guard taking down the Team Series title. You know, kudos to them. They were also the first people to get to play with Guilds of Ravnica sealed in a highly competitive environment. So that was really exciting. But there was a bigger story to come out of this weekend, and that's sad. Not because of what the story is, but because of the fact that it overshadows the accomplishments of the people who did play in the event. And that is the protest done by Jerry Thompson. And before anybody tries to light me up, I have absolutely no problem with what he did. I supported what he did. As someone who once kind of had the dream of the Pro Tour, to see what it looks like now is depressing to me and is a big part of the reason why I'm not aggressively seeking it, why I don't go play these bigger events trying to qualify for it. It's just not feasible for me. It's not financially feasible for me. and especially less so, you know, the running gag right now is the worst thing that can happen to a medium Magic player is to get a good finish at a high level event. Because what happens is you end up trying to chase the dream of riding the Pro Tour gravy train, and it's just not feasible unless you are, like, obscenely good at Magic. And even then, you have to do something else to supplement your income. It's not like it replaces your job. So that was part of the reason that he was protesting. There were other reasons, like the promotion, like the fact that very few people knew that Worlds was last weekend, much less knew who was competing at Worlds. Like, I had no idea who was going, other than Jerry Thompson once he made the announcement. And then I looked into the tweets about Magic World Championships, and I started seeing some names that I recognized. But, I had to do some digging to find it. The same was true of what happened to the player that won Worlds. There was a picture on the Magic Pro Tour Twitter page, which if you don't follow directly, you're not going to see it. There was nothing from Wizards on the Magic the Gathering Twitter page. There was nothing from Wizards on the Magic the Gathering Facebook pages. I didn't see anything. And that was a big part of the reason that Jerry was protesting. And then it was the cheating issue, where a lot of the better known cheaters over the last few years have been allowed to come back and, allegedly, I can't say for sure because I obviously haven't been there, but allegedly were repeating some of the behaviors that they had in the past, and that's not good for the game either. And just kind of a laundry list of things that Wizards really needs to handle better. So Jerry chose to sit out the most lucrative tournament of the year, literally putting his money where his mouth was, in order to call attention to these issues. And then Wizards kind of swept it under the rug and tried not to talk about it all weekend, and I'm sure basically nothing's going to come of it. But, that's for the people who are wondering what in the world people are talking about when they talk about Jerry Thompson and Worlds, that's what we're on about. It's a shame that it ended up overshadowing the accomplishments of Dominguez and the teams and the people that were competing. But it was something that needed to happen. Like, that's a separate thing. One does not necessarily disqualify the other from being good. So if I keep talking about Worlds and I keep talking about Jerry's protest, I'm just going to get really depressed. So we're going to move on. And we're going to talk about things that get us excited again, because I need to be excited about something other than the news that we got this week that Sarah is expecting our third child. So another addition to the Homeward Path family. But Guilds of Ravnica Standard is only a week away, folks. Week away. We can open packs this weekend, and then we can open them again next weekend, and we'll have cards to play with, and we can start playing Guilds of Ravnica Standard in its entirety. I am beyond excited, ecstatic. There's not enough hyperbole in the dictionary for the level of excitement that I'm at right now regarding Standard. The problem I have is I can't keep myself focused on one thing. That is ultimately the biggest issue I have. And it's leading me down a road that in the past would have caused me a lot of trouble trying to prep for this new format, trying to get myself onto a deck, trying to get myself ready to, start playing more, do all the things that I need to do. Decks that are built at the beginning of a format tend to be the most hit or miss that they are, like, over the entire lifespan of a Standard cycle. Because especially when a block like Kaladesh rotates out, the paradigm for the format is completely flipped on its head. Because we haven't played without Kaladesh cards for so long. And Kaladesh cards were so much, Kaladesh and Amonkhet cards were so much better than Ixalan and Dominaria cards, with a couple of exceptions. Specifically Search for Escanta Teferi. That's about it. So having the standard format shrink by four sets, you gain one back, but you shrink by four that are some of the highest power level sets. Or, well, I don't even know if I'd say the highest power level, but just the highest synergy base. Like, the decks that came out of Kaladesh and Amonkhet blocks were powerful, effective decks. They weren't, you know, there were a handful of powerful, singularly powerful cards, but that was just not the strategy you could take, was just jamming a bunch of powerful cards together. It didn't work particularly well that way. So, as we go into this new format, there are some traps that we can fall into. And I'm going to talk about the ones that I'm trying, the two big ones that I'm trying really hard to maintain my discipline on and get myself where I need to be. So the first one is I've got to make sure that whatever I build, I pay the correct amount of respect to the fundamentals of good deck building. I got to make sure I have a deck that has a clean mana curve, that knows its identity, that, you know, whatever it's doing well. And that, you know, that's something that tends to come up a lot at the beginning of a format. Proactive decks tend to be really good early on, largely because the reactive decks are kind of clunky. Like, they don't know for sure what they're doing yet. And if you don't know what you're doing yet, as far as like how you're going to progress from the early to mid game to late game, it's really hard to also be controlling what your opponent's doing. Now, it could be something as simple as if I'm deciding on a control deck, I decide on one that's going to play a lot of removal, commit to playing a lot of removal, and just do it. You know, being able to dominate the board state. But that's really what it boils down to with early format decks, with this new format that we're going into. It's going to be really easy to build a bad deck, but be playing a lot of defensible card choices. So it's really important to adhere to your mana curve, to adhere to making sure you have, you know, a formula, a number system, a mathematical thing to equate your deck to. Like, you know, if you're playing a mid-range deck, let's look at, you know, something like a green-black mid-range deck. You want to make sure you've got a tight mana curve. You know, you don't want to go too far up or too, you know, play too much that's too low, but you also don't want to glut your middle and not have anything to do early in the game. You don't want to be too heavy on interaction, but you don't want to have no interaction. It's this really delicate balance that has to be struck. So I tend to use templates to determine how I build my decks at this stage. You know, whether it's an aggro deck, I like to use the mana curve from Sly. Even if I'm not playing a red deck, I like to use the mana curve from Sly. So I want, you know, X number of one drops, you know, somewhere between 10 and 13 one drops if I can. Make up the difference in other places. Like, the curves are flexible, but you want to at least have a starting point. And that's true of, in your mid-range decks especially. It's true in your control decks. Like, the mono-red deck over the last year, I have played largely on a Sly curve. It's, you know, 10 one drops, like somewhere around 8 two drops, 6 three drops, and 4 four drops, and then burn spells and land. You know, that was where I started, and those numbers fluctuated over the course of the year, but that's kind of where I sat on the red deck. Now, I don't know that it's possible to build a mono red deck on that curve now, because there's just not enough playable cards to fill all those slots, unless you're playing specifically like pirate red, and I'm not super in on pirate red. I'm just not. I can't help it. But that's a place to start. Even, you know, if you look at it and say there's not enough playable one drops in mono red, well, maybe you go red, maybe you go white red. Maybe you go like a white weenie deck that splashes your burn spells. Or play a lot of haste and first strike and double strike creatures and play Path of Metal and, you know, trim on some of the other interaction you might be playing. But it's important to start with a template, to give yourself a point of reference to really try to sketch out what your deck can possibly look like. And it may be something as simple. Like for me, if I were trying to build a green black deck right now, I would probably start with the Huey Jensen, Reed Duke, Owen Tartenwald, the Peach Garden Oath guys, their teamer list from last year. Not for the specific card choices, but for like filling roles for mana curve considerations. You want, you know, they were playing 8-2 drops, 8-3 drops, 4-4 drops, and then 5-5 drops. Four ways to cheat on lands and attune with Aether. You can argue you can do that with Adventurous Impulse right now. Or if you're in for something like, you know, playing a Dinosaurs deck that's basically green and then splashes black cards, like, you can do the Dinosaurs deck the same way. You play X number of 2-drops, X number of 3-drops, and so on up the curve. And then, you know, they had X number of interactive spells at different points on their mana curve. You know, they were, it was 1-2 Magma Spray with the third in the board. It was all 4 Harness Lightning and then X number of Abrades. It was Commit to Memory, Essence Scatter. All these interactive elements that they had access to, they had somewhere around 9 or 10 ways to interact with their opponent, and they were spread across the mana curve. And that's something to keep in mind. That's something that's really important in having a good functional deck in week one. You know, one of my favorite places to look right now for week one would be something like a green-white deck. Because the 3-drops in green-white are pretty fantastic if you really want to beat up on red. And Knight of Autumn does a really good job of making sure it's just not a bad card basically ever. So having, you know, having those kinds of flexible 3-drops is really important. But even you know, going into a control deck, you want to look at some of the lists that have been played previously and kind of see where you can fit cards in that have the same costs. Even control decks have to operate on a mana curve. Kind of important, because you don't want to draw a bunch of 4-drops and get run over. So, I mean, building a deck in a new format is sometimes a little daunting, and it's not a bad thing to use decks that have come before as your guide to figure out how you want your new one to look. You don't have to actually reinvent the magic wheel. Now, the other trap that's really easy to fall into when we lose a set like Kaladesh and are going into a set that looks as exciting and as fun as Guilds of Ravnica, it's really easy to fall into the linear deck trap, where you go all in on a new mechanic, a new keyword, you know, whatever the case may be. You know, I see the Turbo Surveil deck being talked about a lot. I see, you know, green-black undergrowth as like a mechanical identity for a deck. And I kind of want to pump the brakes on that a little bit. Because out of the mechanics that are in the set that I see, the only one that really seems to pay you off for playing a lot of it would be Mentor. Because Mentor is for an aggressive red-white deck. It's on creatures, and those creatures want to be attacking, and that's what you want to be doing in your red-white deck anyway. So what I see with this set is a lot of mechanics that are fair, balanced, and offer a little bit of incentive. They offer a little bit of payoff. They're splashable mechanics. Convoke, there's a couple of cards at the top of your curve you can maybe cheat on if you have some creatures laying around. Or you can, you know, get a little bit of value out of a creature you just played that isn't particularly good in a control matchup, let's say. You know, things of that nature. That's what Convoke looks like in Standard right now to me. You know, a card like Amara, Soul of the Accord, you can run her out on 2, on 3, you can play another creature, tap Amara in that creature, and be able to cast the Conclave Tribunal to exile a permanent and get a creature back. That's not a unfair line of play. It's not a line of play that's going to take the format by storm. But it's a fair exploitation of a mechanic. It pays you off a little bit by letting you double spell a turn early. It's little things that allow what your deck is doing to do it a little better. And that's really what I see out of these main mechanics. Like, Jumpstart is a fairly weak mechanic based on the cards that they printed that have the mechanic. We have a 3-mana deal 2 damage spell that has Jumpstart. We also have Chemist's Insight, which is a fantastic magic card. It is, you know, draw two for four at instant speed, and you can do it again by discarding another card. That's great. I love that card. But it's fair. It's not pushed. It's just, it's a really good card. So what it looks like they tried to do with Guilds of Ravnica was, instead of trying to push you specifically after a linear, they tried to push you towards cards that would supplement regular macro archetypes. There's nothing here that kind of reinvents Magic as we know it, the way something like Energy did, the way things like Eternalize did. Like, you know, Godfarer's Gift and Eternalize cards was a little bit of a different ploy to play Magic. We don't have anything like that in Guilds of Ravnica. Surveil is card selection. That's what you want in your tempo decks and your control decks. You want card selection. It makes your tempo decks and control decks better. You don't have to go all the way in on Surveil and Surveil payoffs in order to utilize it. And that's the important thing to remember, is it's really easy to fall into the trap of, I've got to play every card with this mechanic on it because I like using this mechanic. If you're not getting paid off in a meaningful way for doing that, you're hurting yourself. You know, playing, for example, playing the raid deck over the last year, I've tried it. I thought it was fun. It wasn't good. There's just not enough of a payoff for playing a bunch of cards that are only good when you have creatures on the board and are attacking with them. On balance, a card like Charter Course is fantastic, even though you're not all the way in on Raid, because Charter Course is a really good card in kind of an aggressive tempo-centric strategy, because it's a 2-mana spell, so you can double spell on 4. You know, attack you with my Kitesail Freebooter, draw 2 cards, leave up counter magic and removal. That's fine. That's absolutely fine. And that's something that I'm going to work on, but like, there's a difference between adding some cards that supplement what your deck does and going all the way in on a mechanic to the point that it makes your deck worse. So, that's the biggest trap that I tend to fall into, and it's one that I'm really trying hard not to do this time. You know, the only mechanic I can see that's a little bit parasitic is something like Mentor, where you want a lot of cards with Mentor and you want them to scale as the game goes along. Honestly, best card with Mentor, hands down to me, is still Legion War Boss, and that card is just way better in something like a Goblin Tribal deck than it is in something like, you know, a dedicated Mentor deck. But we'll see. I'm absolutely certain I'm going to be wrong about a lot of this. That's the other beauty of Magic. We can make predictions, we can try to adhere to disciplines, and then somebody just kind of throws all that to the wind and reinvents the wheel anyway, and you know, we end up trying to figure out how to change to a warping format. So, it is what it is. The short version of it is, if you're going to be an aggro deck, make sure you're an aggro deck. Make sure you're killing your opponent as quickly and efficiently as you can. If you're going to be a mid-range deck, decide which end of the spectrum you're going to be on. If you're going to be an aggressive mid-range deck, play a lot of big creatures. Make sure you can dominate board stalls by just having the biggest thing on the board. Make your opponent have to trade multiple cards for it. If you're going to be a reactive mid-range deck, make sure you're playing as close to the right removal as you can. Make sure you've got a good spread of cards to interact, and then good, powerful ways to close the game out. You know, Grixis mid-range comes to mind there. That deck looks like it's going to be fun. Nicol Bolas is a really good corner turner, even if people are going to be playing Nullhide Ferox. It looks like it's going to be fun. Looks like it's going to be pretty good. But you got to make sure you're playing the right kind of cards, make sure you're playing the right number of each of those cards, and don't get bogged down in trying to get paid off for playing a bunch of Surveil cards. You want to play a bunch of Surveil cards because you want to see more cards. You know, that's the thing. We've had some linear mechanics in Standard in the last year that just haven't worked out. Tribes, we've had Vampires, we've had Merfolk, we've had Dinosaurs, and they've been fun, they've been interesting, they haven't been very good. So, especially in a new Standard format, just stick to what we know. And I'm not saying you can't build like a Golgari mid-range deck that plays out a lot of the graveyard synergy. That's fine. But just make sure if you're doing it that you're getting paid off for it. You know, playing your Stitcher Supplier, Glow Spore Shaman, and, you know, Jade Light Ranger, Merfolk Branchwalker, playing ways to load your graveyard is great as long as you can take advantage of it in a meaningful way. Necrotic Wound, being able to scale up and trade in a tempo-efficient manner, take some stress off your Assassin's Trophies. Being able to cast 4-drop creatures that are as big as 5-5, 6-6, 7-7s with haste, that's a meaningful payoff. Getting a 6-6 creature for as little as, you know, 2 or 3 mana, that's a meaningful payoff. But you're still fundamentally a black-green mid-range deck that just, instead of playing regular card advantage, you're trying to play your graveyard. That's fine. You're getting paid off in a meaningful way for playing the Undergrowth cards, but you're not doing it in a way that makes your deck bad if you don't have them. That's the key. You know, especially when the format shrinks, powerful cards trump, or powerful cards trump powerful, or, you know, medium synergies, but good deck building trumps both. You know, tight, disciplined lists tend to do better early on than otherwise. And then, I mean, that's all I can say. When I sit down, the deck that I'm working on the most right now, the one that I am the most intrigued by going into this format, is blue-black as kind of a tempo shell. I want to be able to get on the board fairly early against a control deck and be able to scare them, but I also want to be disruptive and interactive enough to be able to hold my own against aggro. It's an archetype that I love. It's an archetype that I play entirely too much, but it's one that I play comfortably, and it's one that I feel like is primed for a little bit of a resurgence thanks to all the card selection that we have. Not just the Surveil cards, but when you couple the Surveil cards with things like Opt and Charter Course. So I want to sit down and work on that. It would be really easy for me to take PV's Turbo Surveil list and just try to make a couple of alterations to it and just run it back. I can't do it. I can't be in, especially in a standard format that's going to feature Assassin's Trophy, I can't be in on a card like Dimir Spybug that needs multiple turns of investment to pay you off in a meaningful way. So, you know, I'm going to try to stick to a reasonable mana curve, play a good spread of interaction, and just make sure my deck is tight, make sure it's good to go. Even though it's something that's off the beaten path, even though I'm not just taking a stock list and making a few changes to suit what I think I'm up against, it's still important to make sure you're adhering to good, solid, fundamental Magic and avoiding the traps of, you know, trying out too many cool new things or, you know, committing too hard to something that's not going to pay you off for what you're doing. And that's going to wrap us up this week. Thanks again for listening. I obviously enjoy recording it. Two things. One, I have a Patreon goal, at least for myself. If we can get to $20 a month, in other words, 3 more patrons, I will get back on Magic Online and I will start playing some. I'm going to be joining the Magic Arena beta this weekend. I did not do the closed beta. I didn't feel like I had the time with everything that was going on. Things are starting to settle out a little bit better, even with the move on the horizon. So I'm going to start trying to play more Magic in some form so that I can better inform everybody, you know, have a little bit more insight to give. And beyond that, I mean, just check out all the cool stuff that I mentioned earlier. Check out the rest of the network, check out the sponsor. And if you feel like you are getting something back out of this show enough to feel like you can help or you want to help, please don't hesitate to donate. And if you don't like the rewards, please just let me know. That's all I ask. And that brings me to my favorite segment every week. And I've got to take the phone off airplane mode and pull it up. Because as an MTG dad, I love me some dad humor. And my Twitter outreach program, my social media outreach program every week is hashtag MTG Dad Jokes. We have one from Steam Elephant on Twitter. Says, what's the most popular deck in Russia?
That would be Boris Agro.
Boris? Agro? Anyway. Let's see. What else do we have here? We had Taryn Qualls was playing around with some decks this weekend, and there was a deck sent to him called Crocodile Jundee. I love that so much I had to laugh. I just had to. And then we had, let's find it. Let's see. Trying to pull it up. Phone is not cooperating. I, of course, shared the thread in the Facebook. Looks like, let's see. Post from my groups. This is agonizing how long this is taking. So we have Sarah found two on Reddit. One was via Reddit user Indivisible Inc. How many Magic players does it take to screw in a light bulb? It's three. One to do it, two to stand and watch, telling him after the fact how he could have done it three turns faster. The other is from Reddit user Yukon Vasara. How do you make a small fortune playing Magic? This one's going to hurt a lot of people. You start with a large fortune. That's the easiest, especially in light of the thing with the Pro Tour this weekend. Like, that's painfully accurate. That's almost a little too real. And then Ryan Hickman from the local game store says, how many snakes are on this plane? Yeah, I'm Naga fan. Naga fan. Yeah. Anyway, thanks again for listening, everybody. I hope you enjoyed it. Let me know what you want to hear about next week. I'm going to do some testing in Modern. Maybe get some insight there, but all the way around, I cannot tell you enough how much I enjoy doing this. And, please, if you have any suggestions on how to make this better for you, the listener, please let me know. I will be happy to take them into consideration. So until next week, gang, thanks again. I will catch you then. And until then, keep at it.